like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Lisa Kemmerer, professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University, Billings, who describes herself as a philosopher activist working on behalf of non-human animals, the environment, and disempowered human beings. Dr. Kemmerer has written and or edited 9 books, including Bare Necessities, Rescue, Rehabilitation, Sanctuary, and Advocacy, an anthology she edited that features more than 24 contributors, including Kemmerer herself, addressing a myriad of bear species and issues. The book is brimming with ideas and important information about bears across the globe, whether it's environmental and habitat changes, the challenges they face, or the array of means by which bears are routinely exploited and abused for entertainment or for alleged medicinal purposes, is when Asian bears are kept in captivity in order for their bile to be harvested daily. And of course, many of the issues explored in this book are relevant to the bear hunt held in Florida last year and considered again this year. We'll discuss various aspects of the bear world when I speak with Dr. Lisa Kemmerer in a moment here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak briefly with Alana Rogers of Pig Advocates League, or PAL, a nonprofit organization whose stated mission is to protect pigs of all sizes and is deeply involved with helping find homes for the 130-plus pigs seized from Darlin's, the Polk City facility I mentioned on last week's show, where the owners were charged with 138 counts of animal neglect and 3 counts of felony animal abuse. There are tremendous expenses involved in caring for the pigs and other animals removed from the property, as well as relocating the pigs. We'll discuss these details and other aspects of this case with Alana Rogers later in the program. Right now, though, let's meet Dr. Kemmerer and delve into bear necessities with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Lisa Kemmerer to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Kemmerer.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals and getting up extra early out there on the West Coast to do so. So I'm eager to start talking bears, and I gather from some of the feedback I've gotten already that there's more than a few people listening who are equally eager to hear us talking bears. But first, I'd like to hear something about your work as an academic, as well as a prolific author and editor. In terms of your own academic training, I'm interested that part of that path included studying at Harvard Divinity School. Tell me about that. What drew you there, and how did that experience influence you?
Well, my journey to where I am has definitely been one of just following the road of trying to figure out what mattered most to me and living into it. So I was not born an academic. I was born an activist, a person of sensitivities. And as I moved along, I just kept bumping into things that kind of told me where to go. And ultimately, being a teacher, being an academic, the important thing was to become a teacher so that I could try to bring about some changes. And specifically, through Divinity School, I was interested in bringing about changes against violence more broadly, which I experienced when I traveled. I kept dropping out of school. I kind of hated school. So when I traveled, I kept seeing that much of our fighting is over religion. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go that route and try to teach people about peace and compassion through the avenue of religious ethics.
Well, that makes sense, although I don't often get to talk to a PhD who says I hated school, so that's interesting. While at Harvard Divinity School, to what extent did you, along with the impulse that you outlined there that sent you in that direction, did you consider pursuing at any point some sort of ministry?
Well, that's a very conventional path. Mm-hmm. I don't think that would have been possible for me. You kind of have to swallow a book of, you know, here's what you are, was never going to work.
So you went there expressly with the background kind of more as an activist rather than academic, and just seeing what you could learn there, absorb there, that would help your already sort of broader mission than something like an actual ministry itself.
Well, definitely. But of course, ministry is activism. Definitely had that, you know, it's that part of the same package, and I wouldn't say, in fact, that what I do isn't ministry. It's just a different kind of ministry, and it's far less, you know, in the ministry you can actually, you know, have a little seat that you plop into, and it's all figured out for you, kind of the part I've always missed out on.
Well, that's also sounds like the part you weren't gigantically interested, because it sounds like you kind of wanted to keep pushing and reinventing.
Absolutely, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah. So you don't have to know too much about the university world to know that to advance your career, increase your prospects of tenure, and so on, the key adage is publish or perish. I dare say there's not too much risk of your perishing, given the tremendous amount of publishing you've done over the years. At this point, if I've kept up, you're credited with having written and or edited 9 books, and I suspect there's probably at least one more written or in the works. Topics of these books represent some pretty sprawling terrain. What drove that? Is it partly reflecting your own Catholic with a small C taste, or what other factors are at play?
Again, very much it's my wandering, figuring out how much things were connected. And I didn't ever write because I had a job and needed to keep it. I've been writing since I was much younger. I've always loved to write as a way of expressing ideas, promoting change, or to get people to think. So that was a given. And if anything, my writing, I suppose, would have endangered my security, because I have never written anything but exactly what I know. And in animal ethics, that can be a little bit of a problem. But it just, my university's been great, and it never has been a problem, I guess. And for me, too, I wasn't interested in the best university I could get to. I need space, and I know that. I picked Montana because of the wide open spaces, and I never applied to places and cities. I didn't want to be there. So again, kind of knowing who I am and what mattered to me, my career had to kind of shape around that and shake out around the realities of being me.
Well, that makes sense. And it sounds like whether they didn't fully understand or embrace necessarily all of your writings, that the university has been very supportive, and whether it's falls within the academic realm or not, or some of them do. I mean, there is a lot of writing done. I mean, not just the books, but at least I looked at some of the published papers and other articles, and definitely reflects a love of writing, but it also there's a lot of ambition and ideas there too.
I am absolutely a hyperactive person as far as just getting things done. I don't pause, and I just work through things. I'm currently working on a book on violence, which has taken, and the religion book, for example, took about 15 years to write. So one reason they kind of all came out in a row, I think 10 books, there was 9 books in 10 years, I think is what it ended up being, is because they in some ways overlapped what I was putting together. So the one I'm working on now, on violence, I'm really glad that I'm now tenured, although it would never have stopped me from doing exactly what I'm doing.
In some ways, though, it sounds like you might be circling back, given the focus of this book, because you kind of explained a moment ago that part of what drove you, for example, to go to the Harvard Divinity School was thinking about, and unfortunately, I guess, firsthand experiences with violence.
Yeah, and you're right. I'm circling back to kind of, yeah, that's an interesting comment. It's absolutely true, exploring something that kind of lies behind a lot of what's bothered me. Of course, if I look back when I was a little kid, I was definitely an animal activist then. I remember being so horrified and offended by the things I would see and watch in the world. I suppose if a kid was picked on, that bothered me a lot too, but they're never picked on the way that animals can be and are. So that part of me has always been there. And now, yeah, applying the larger violence back to look at animal activism and violence, I'm really excited about the topic, but it's huge and challenging.
No doubt. And so where, Dr. Cameron, where did you grow up? Where was this where you first felt those feelings as a precocious animal activist?
Rural Washington State.
Okay.
Pretty quiet little place.
Well, it sounds like then that maybe hooks into why you've chosen to land at Montana State University Billings versus, you said, some of the other kinds of institutions that you certainly, with your training and background and accomplishments, could certainly go if that were of interest.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, too, the high energy, I just need space for my high energy. And Montana provides it. And the woods that we had when I was a kid definitely provided as well. Gave me also some insights into other beings that I might not have had in the city.
This, I think, may bring us in some ways to Bare Necessities. How did the idea for Bare Necessities come about? What drew you to working on a book about bears?
Well, my first book on an individual species was on primates. That was called Primate People. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my very first books to come out. So the reason I picked that book is that there are individuals who are very focused on certain animals, and primates are one of them, and bears are one of them. And so the idea was, if I could write a book about those species that would attract a larger group of more conventional is really the wrong word, a certain group of people who could be pulled closer on board with looking at animal issues, well, that was the intent and that was the purpose. So with primates, there's a lot of people who think that they're very close to what human beings are and so are very interested in primates. And with bears, I don't know what draws people to bears, their size, their fear of them. I don't know, but I know it's true. So I was trying to get people who are interested in bear stories and bears themselves to recognize the larger picture of consumption, population problems, and going vegan, and the sorts of ideas that the larger animal activist group is aware of.
When you first started thinking, okay, I think my next book is going to be a bear book, was it immediately also part of that thinking that, hey, this will be an anthology and I will have a variety of contributors?
Well, I knew it would have to be an anthology. One of the reasons I put together anthologies is to get the voices of activists on paper. And they often don't have a chance, but they don't have time to write. The mess of publishing, they often are not skilled writers, so it takes a ton of editing and just lots of time to work with them because they can be pulled out into the field all of a sudden or a new bear lands in, they're busy for. So you have to be very patient. It takes a lot of time, and you have to really be willing to do a lot of the writing and rewriting yourself. So I knew from the start this would be, especially having done primate people, I knew it would be time intensive. And the same with Sister Species and Speaking Up for Animals, the books about women. The anthologies were a way of getting the voices, bringing a diversity of voices to the table that connect different problems all together. And I absolutely knew I would need other voices to do that.
Well, let me first let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Lisa Kammerer, a professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University, Billings. She has written and edited 9 books, including Bear Necessities, Rescue, Rehabilitation, Sanctuary, and Advocacy, recently released in paperback. If you'd like to ask Dr. Kammerer a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So with that in mind and your experience with the primate anthology and the sister species one as well, I guess, what was involved in selecting the contributors for Bear Necessities? How did you cast that net?
Well, I'm such a random human. I've kind of explained how my life is very much of one of wandering. And I would say my books come together in the same way, as through wandering and through learning as I go and finding out and throwing the net out there and see who grabs a hold of it and wants to come in. And then often they would point me in directions. And so it was very much in process and not something I could really plan out. And I think one of the important things with the anthologies I've done is being open and being ready to grab whatever comes along that is part of the book that I may or may not have known about. And basically, you know, what do I know about bears when I started? Very little. What I knew was they were part of a bigger picture and could help draw in a readership that would be interested in that larger picture.
One thing that's interesting about being open is that you mentioned a moment ago that, I guess in some cases at least, and I guess we won't necessarily identify who's who in this, some of the contributors to some of the anthropologies you worked on, certainly apparently including Bear Necessities, aren't necessarily writers or particularly accomplished writers. And so one of your tasks, I guess, as the editor and person overseeing that anthology is to help rewrite, edit, shape. But with that in mind, I guess it also opens up a broader slate of possible contributors. Did you assign topics when you figured out who you would have contribute to the book, or did they pitch them to you, or how did that work?
Boy, it's a great question. How does that work? I guess I do a lot of internet searching. Well, initially, the idea came through my sister, who said, well, why don't you do a book on birds? She was one, or bears, and she's one who also had suggested primates. So the idea didn't even originate with me. And I realized the value of that for pulling in a larger group. So then I just had to go Google it and start looking up who's out there and what's happening with bears. And I would just prepare a letter of introduction of who I am and what the project is. And the one thing I was always very careful about was I would never say things like, you know, this is a flaming radical vegan animal liberationist. No, you never say that. So you put together a letter that basically says we're going to get the word out for bears. And so people who are in the bear world who may not be a part of that larger world wouldn't be frightened away. And then through them, I would find out what the issues are and other people that might need to be pulled on board if I could. And I just would kind of follow leads, and then the book would take shape. I'd figure out what the different sections would be once the essays are all in. And then some of the sections might be weak, and then I would say, okay, here's a section, but I need 2 more essays. and then I'd have to go back and find more people. And that's kind of how it unfolds.
As you kind of noted earlier, it does sound pretty labor intensive.
Yes.
Let's look at some specific pieces and or species. I mean, first of all, the book is, as I think I mentioned in an email I sent to you, is brimming with information, thanks to, I guess, all these contributors that you found and all the work and shepherding and rewriting or editing that may have gone on.
Their expertise is so critical.
Yeah. And as I think I mentioned in that same note, that I mean, the book is as much about ideas, ultimately, as it is about bears. And there's more than a few pieces that deal with bears that are exploited or worse across the world. Authors of those essays reflect a commitment to improving life for those bears from Lake Tahoe all the way to Pakistan. And many radiate a real spirit of optimism that their commitment, their passion can make things better for those bears. And in many cases, it's demonstrated that they do. Toward that end, and because some listeners may be unaware of the shadowy world of biofarms, let's spend a moment on that enterprise, a not insignificant element of bear necessities. Let's talk a little bit about Jill Robinson and her piece, and anything you want to say about biofarms, what they are, how they work, and what their status is currently versus more historically.
Biofarms are one of the saddest situations for animals that exist. And they're kept in such tiny cages where literally they can't move. And I think one of the problems is that these happen in parts of the world where there is not even rudimentary animal welfare laws. So they literally can do anything they want. And, of course, I want to remind us that even in our own country, many of the animals, many quote-unquote animals somehow manage to fall outside of those animal welfare laws specifically created for animal experimentation and the animal food industry. So it's not unique in that sense, but where wild animals are concerned, I think it is. So bears are kept in these tiny, tiny cages, and they're hooked up to these shunts that come out of their bile, which collects the fluid from their bile, and then they use it for Chinese medicines kind of in different places around the world, including here. There's a market for it here. So it's an example of something that in our international world can affect bears first on farms where their lives are just completely, I don't know, they're like a bile in a cage. It's like they're not a being. So in that sense, it is just horrific how they're handled. But because of this industry, bears all over the world are at risk of being killed for their bile, because you can either put them up to a shunt and pull the fluid out of their bile, or you can simply kill them and take their bile. So in the United States, it's one of the reasons black bears are poached in places where they're not supposed to be shot or trapped, is because they're taking their bile.
And one of the key pieces on this in the book is by Jill Robinson, who, by the way, was a guest on the show a few years back, and she and her organization, I should say, have been instrumental.
She was awesome working with her, and she's been in other books of mine, and she's just a bright light.
Yeah, and she and her organization have been really instrumental in trying to fight.
Very successful.
Yeah.
Very dedicated. Yeah, I love working with her. She's one who's just a joy to work with because she gets the job done, and she never fusses about edits. She gets that this is a process for bears. It's not about our own egos or none of that matters. What matters is getting this piece ready, getting it a book, getting it out there for the bears and for animals more broadly in the earth and, you know, all the issues that come together.
And again, just as we're talking about now, I just think any sort of further exposure and again, Animals Asia Foundation that she runs does so much good work in that way and in other ways too.
If you're out there looking for a group to support, I think she's first rate. She's definitely one I would recommend.
Cool. All right, well, we've got some emails and some callers. Let's get others involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Kemmerer.
Yes, I just want to say, first of all, thank you for standing up for the bears and for being a public intellectual all these years. It's very rare, more and more rare. A couple of things. I don't know if you're aware or if Duncan already mentioned it, but Florida has this ignominious thing of a bear hunt, and I'd like to hear your comments on hunting in general. There's that guy that just speared a bear and put a happy, happy YouTube video up. I see that China is leading the world in imprisoning bears and stealing their bile. And in general, the reason I went vegan is because I know that the food industries do a variation of the bile thing to almost all the animals, especially dairy, where the mother cows are hooked up and they're stealing milk meant for their babies. So what do you think about all those topics and about the human mentality behind why we enslave all other creatures?
All right. Thank you for your call. Dr. Kemmerer, I was going to, of course, get into Florida and the bear hunt later, but we're into it now. So feel free to respond to at least some of his comments and questions, and I probably have some others of my own.
Yeah, thank you for that call. That's and again, there's like five different major topics in there. I kind of want to gravitate right to that last one about, well, actually, I want to first say, you're right on that these things are all connected, that you come into one idea and it leads to another and another. And it's why we end up going vegan, is we recognize there's just too many things connected, and diet's one of them, to the exploitation, the cruelty, and the destruction. And your last comment was the biggest and the broadest one. What is it with humans? Why are we like this? And that is, it's the golden question. And I think, ultimately, of course, I'm a philosopher. And so that's why this idea interests me so much. I think humans fail to see who they are. That's my sense. We don't recognize that we're here momentarily for a very short time, so we don't grasp what might really matter in the bigger scheme of things. We get very focused on the moment. So all of the destruction that we do is a matter of thoughtlessness, greed, this idea of grasping and consumption, that at the end of the day, and notice that links right to Buddhism and religion, and this is why at the end of the day, I ended up chasing down so many trails in my concern for the earth and animals and the sufferings that are going on, is that they're all connected. So Buddhism teaches to stop the grasping. That's a key idea that all of us could get a hold of that would really help us with this. And I think, of course, another element, and one of the reasons I became a professor, and the reason I write, is ignorance. People don't know, right? So the caller, you used to eat other animals, as did I, as most of us did. At some point, we learned. At some point, we started to see the connections, and at some point, we were then able to opt out because of information that came in. So the importance of education is probably one of the first things I point out, and one of the second would be stepping back and thinking about life. So our education has to also be one of who are we and what is our point here and how should we reflect that in our lives.
Okay, well, I think that, like you said, there was a lot in the caller's questions and comments, but I think
there's a whole other issue you bring up, hunting, which the third chapter, I wrote a book called Eating Earth. The third chapter is all about hunting, and it's one of my favorite things I've ever written, and the reason being that I just have so much fun with it. It's the sort of topic you can just go to town on. And I'm also really glad that on this topic it was a man speaking, because one of the things I do is I go after this vision of males as, you know, so much of hunting is just about being a man, but also a lot of it is just about propaganda. It's about money for fish and game and how they get it, and then this nonsense of it being a tradition that needs to be maintained, so there's something patriotic in it. I mean, it's just this mess, this gnarly mess of completely insane ideas that keeps it going when it's no longer necessary. So thank you for bringing up all these great issues, and we didn't even get to the Florida bears.
Well, here's the thing. So since he did bring it up, we'll jump ahead to what I imagine would be later in the conversation. But over the course of the book, you really see how issues or cultural behaviors that at first might seem specific to that country or that bear often end up operating on a more universal level, whether it's the impact of habitat change or the way that countries or cultures exploit bears or other animals. And so there are elements that apply to all kinds of areas and viewpoints about animals and how they're treated. So one of the chapters that you actually authored, that we should note, that since we haven't really, that you write or co-write a handful of the pieces in Bear Necessities. So one of the chapters you author is entitled U.S. Wildlife Agencies Outdated, Misguided, and Destructive, which I think really has particular relevance to those out in Florida, where, again, there was a bear hunt that happened last year and almost another one that happened this year, thankfully did not. But can you outline some of the sort of salient points of that chapter, including, you kind of alluded a little bit to this already, but how those boards and bodies are often peopled with hunters and like-minded others. And interestingly, as you point out, that this some of this goes all the way back to Roosevelt, his ideas about hunting and just how that's sort of carried through in some form or another all the way to now, and some of the same, very people making decisions about the Florida bear hunt.
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic because it is historic. It's connected with visions of masculinity, ideas of masculinity, and ultimately it has such a terrible effect on the animal ecosystems and the earth more broadly. So we need conservation. and conservation versus preservation. Preserving is just leaving it alone. Conservation is conserving it for humanity. So always being clear that these two words have very different meanings, even though they're often juxtaposed or used interchangeably. They're not interchangeable. We set up conservation because of and for hunters when it began. The hunters, at some point early in the 20th century, they figured out, you know, we're not going to have any animals left if we carry on the way we are, if we just keep blasting at them freely. So they set up conservation, and they were specifically conserving hunted animals for hunters. So remembering that is really important, that that's how this organization was set up. So Fish and Game is part of this older institution of animals for people. And it's not even just for people. It's hunted animals for hunters. And that's why you have things like reserves, game reserves, right? So you think, ooh, look, this is going to be a wildlife place where it's like a sanctuary. No. This is all about target species being kept there so that hunters can come, have somewhere to come and kill them. And this was very connected with the idea of masculinity, of making boys into men, that they needed to learn how to kill, that this was part of being a man. So they had to preserve this tradition. And even today, we have legislation going through in different states that's trying to protect hunting as a tradition so that it can't be touched by the now growing power of animal liberationists and animal advocates who want to change that. So you can see here you have a hold of something that is just simply powerful and gigantic with tons of money. And, of course, the ones in Fish and Game are hunters. They want to preserve their practices, and they will go to almost any ends. Well, I can't blame them. They're simply ignorant. They haven't ever stepped back and say, what are we doing here? Do we really care about nature? My guess is, yes, you do. All right, well, then this you don't need to conserve certain species for killing, because when you do that, you foul up ecosystems. So when you're killing when you are growing certain populations like ungulates for killing, you end up killing predators and preserving ungulates. You're messing with ecosystems. And when you do that, you're not doing something good for nature. So if they would even just step back and recognize that. And instead, of course, when the money has started to wane, less and less people are hunting, more and more people are urban. They're doing crazy things like trying to target females because they get that, you know, this is kind of a man tradition and they liked it that way. But on the other hand, if it's going to die out, what they need is mothers and their children to make it stay in there. So what they've done is they have these specific organizations now that target females to get them interested in hunting, because when the mom goes, the kids go with her, and when the kids go, it becomes part of their kind of cultural tradition that they'll maintain. So you can see just how huge and ugly this is. And bears are, of course, just one species that is targeted. And bizarrely, masculinity. The bear is viewed as big, powerful, mighty. Now, anybody who's ever seen a black bear, they run away top speed. In fact, grizzlies, frankly, the brown bears do the same thing. They will run away. They're terrified when they see people. But this idea of something big and powerful, ideally something that can kill you, and you kill that being instead, so there's the dominance and the hierarchy. All right, I've gone off. This is a great subject.
And one of our email questions hooks into this, and I want to get into some other stuff because I'm afraid we're going to run out of time well before we've gotten anywhere near some of the stuff I was hoping to discuss. But one of our emailers says, "Hi, Duncan. Has your guest studied the problems of overdevelopment in bear habitat in Florida? It's ridiculous how many ugly housing developments are being built all around Florida. Why can't we preserve more land for the bears and other animals?" Now,
of course, we know why, right?
Yeah.
Because we keep reproducing and we keep consuming. So we need to stop. We need to know. I mean, we just need to make that decision that we don't need more people on the planet. There's nothing special about my genes. My genes are pretty much like everyone else's. I mean, we got 98% shared with other primates. That's just how similar we all are. So, and also we can invest, rather than invest in our own genes, we could do things like become teachers, which is a way of investing in and shaping the world more broadly. So we need to rethink our reproduction behaviors and our consumption, right? Because even if we did have all these new people, if we didn't all think we needed a house out in some rural area, then the bears would have somewhere to live. So it's a two-pronged problem that each of us needs to address and speak out on.
Yeah, well, one of the key words, I think, in this emailer's question is overdevelopment, which ties into some of your responses. But yeah, if you keep building and clearing and doing all kinds of things and you're encroaching on bears and other animals, obviously, habitat, you're going to have a myriad of problems. And since we are starting to run out of time, I want to be sure on a different note that we've got habitat, but of course we've got climate change and other things. So while I mentioned a spirit of optimism that sort of permeates much of the book, even amidst some pretty bleak circumstances. But the piece about polar bears by Cassie Siegel and Brendan Cummins feels a lot less upbeat, sort of telegraphed by the title, Polar Bears Watching Extinction in Real Time. Any comments you'd like to offer on that chapter and the picture it paints of the severe challenges faced by polar bears in the wake of climate change and global warming?
Well, they're an indicator species, and in some senses, this is why a book on bears. It's somebody we notice. It's a bunch of beings we actually care about, as opposed to all the others that are suffering that we don't seem to care about. Ones we can't see that are in the oceans, ones that are small and less visible to us. So, yes, the polar bears tug at our heartstrings, and they should, but no more or less than any other species out there. We see the floods. Think of all the animals right now that are being flooded in Louisiana that are dying underwater. There's the fires in California. Think of the animals that die in those fires. So if you want to look at it just on an individual basis, the changes and the problems that we're creating, well, it isn't just an individual polar bear that's starving to death on an ice floe. These are the problems that we are causing, that fundamentally are causing other beings far more pain, at least now, and as well as other people. I know when I was doing some research in Africa, the people there said, we don't know when it's going to rain anymore. We don't know what to plant or when to plant it. So we, the powerful, consuming, reproducing people with too much money and too little heart, are causing these problems to other beings, and polar bears are a wonderful way of starting to open that door and really look at what we're doing.
For sure. This is Talking Animals with Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Dr. Lisa Kemmerer, who's written and or edited 9 books, including Bear Necessities, Rescue, Rehabilitation, Sanctuary, and Advocacy, recently out now in paperback. We are just in the last minute or two, unfortunately, of our time, but if you have a quick question, we can probably entertain that. You can call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. And sort of overlapping, I think, probably some of your comments about habitat and responding to the previous emailer's question. One emailer said, what does your guest think of quote-unquote wildlife management areas in Florida? And then I think maybe answers their own question somewhat with the word I can't say on the radio, abbreviated BS. They're killing grounds. So
yeah, I call that wildlife manipulation, not management. And that's all it is. It's those with power and money manipulating wildlife for their pleasures.
All right, let's take a very cool question. Hi, you're on. Oh, we lost them. Okay, so let me, in our last moment here, Dr. Kemmerer, let me kind of bring it back in a way to sort of how we began. How does your faith, or whatever form that takes, help you when dealing with animal abuse, neglect, cruelty, and just other sort of related upsetting experiences?
I'm glad you asked that question, because it is actually the note I want to end on, and that's, you talk about my optimism. The animals are suffering terribly. They are dying perpetually. It is bleak. But it does us no good to be bleak. We have to have the energy and the positive outlook to do what we can do and to never give up. And ultimately, what that means is first shaping our own lives. So having that commitment, that faith, that strength to say, this is what I see, this is what I know, and this is how I'm going to live. And then that is how we shape the world. And then if we can also speak out or write, we can also help bring larger changes to the world, for animals, for the earth, and of course also for humanity. But we are the problem, and it is our very own selves that we need to reshape. But we have to be positive to make that happen.
Wow. Okay. I think that's the perfect note at which to leave this conversation. We've been speaking with Dr. Lisa Kemmerer. Again, her most recent book that she's written, or in this case edited, but also written a lot of pieces for, is called Bear Necessities, Rescue, Rehabilitation, Sanctuary, and Advocacy. It is out now in paperback. It's a long story why, but it's a little bit pricey as paperbacks go. But again, it's, as you've hopefully gotten a sense of, chocolate chock full of information. A lot of things we didn't get to about bears and issues across the globe. And she also has a website, Lisa Kemmerer. That's KEMMERER.com. So, Dr. Kemmerer, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. In a moment, I'll have a brief conversation with Alana Rogers of Pig Advocates League, or PAL, and their efforts to help care for and relocate the more than 130 pigs seized in the arrest last week at Darlin's in Polk City. It's a big case. These pigs need help, and the people helping these pigs need help. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. We're going to hear a piece that ties into our conversation a little bit with Dr. Kemmerer, as well as to life in Florida and, of course, the alligator hunt that's now underway. But anyway, this is Jeff Wayne with Part of the Wolf, the Bear, and the Alligator in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
So I get to the condo, I unpack, and I thought, well, I'm going to go out and take a walk and take a look at Alaska. Look outside, there's a wolf out there. I call the condo manager, hey, there's a wolf out there.
Well, that's Ray.
I don't care what his name is. I didn't travel 2,000 miles to be on a first name basis with a wolf.
Oh, he's a pet. Just call him to you.
This isn't the object of what my desire is. I'm afraid of this thing, so I stayed in the condo all that week because this pet wolf's out running around. I'm not tangling with a wolf. The next week, I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska. Now, this is incredible. Very small city. I can't wait to get out and look around. And the club manager tells me, now listen, don't go on the outskirts of town. There's bears, they'll attack you. What's happening here? He says, sometimes they come in this city and attack people. So this is terrible. He said, well, if one sees you, act like you're dead. I said, brother, I won't have to act. He'll just come over and sniff you for a little while. He's not going to be smelling me long, I'll tell you that. Said he's going to test to see if you're dead or not. He's going to take his paw and bang you in the chest a couple times, but don't make any noise. Do you know how big a bear's paw is? Cracking my ribs, make no noise? So he said, well, if you can't act like you're dead, then find a hill to run down. Now imagine this. You're out here. Here's a bear. And you're supposed to say, stop. Let me find a hill. I don't know the geography of this area. Why do I want to run down a hill? Well, the bear's front legs are shorter than his back legs, and he can't run down the hill. That's right, he'll roll and be waiting for me at the bottom. A month later, I'm in Miami, Florida, and I'm playing golf. We're next to a canal. I see this thing that looks like a log move. Uh-oh, watch out. I said, what is that? That looks like an alligator. The guy next to me, that's a gator. Keep your eye on that ball. I'm going to keep my eye on that alligator. Brother, that's a handicap right there. And none of these people seem that nervous about any of this. So I said to him, I said, well, I guess, you know, you're sort of comfortable because we can outrun that alligator. Oh, no, no, no. Alligator goes 35 miles an hour, fast as a man, knocks you over with the tail, grabs you with the teeth, drags you under the water, drowns you, and eats you for a couple days. I don't need this information. I came out a crappy golfer. Now I'm winding up a human snack bar. But if the alligator starts to run after you, zigzag, because he can't zig, that's it, stop. His name is Ray, run down a hill, it's over.
That was Jeff Wayne with Part of a Piece called The Wolf, the Bear, and the Alligator, taken from his album, Jeff Comedy Jam. Now, let's move to my brief conversation with Alana Rogers of Pig Advocates League about more than 130 pigs that need help. One form or another. Let's welcome Alana Rogers to Talking Animals. Good morning, Alana.
Good morning.
So, thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. First, give us maybe a brief overview of what Pig Advocates League is and what it does.
Pig Advocates League is an organization that is basically wanting to advocate and educate for all pigs across the country, helping with placement, basically work on possibly getting some laws changed, and just overall educating the masses in regards to, in essence, pet pigs, which has become a major problem within the U.S.
And so during the course of the show, I've alluded to the arrest made last week at Darlin's in Polk City. But maybe you could sort of outline the key elements of the case.
Sure, I can try. Pretty much there's been many rumblings and allegations in regards to Darlin's for several years. PETA ended up
sending some volunteers out there to do, in essence, hidden video, undercover video, to see what all was going on. And unfortunately, livestock laws are pretty weak in Florida, so in order to get any animal cruelty charges or anything of the sort to stick, you've got to have a lot of evidence. So they were out there for a while documenting, et cetera, and then took all of their findings to the Polk County Sheriff's Office, who then proceeded with charges. There's most of it stems from neglect.
Yeah. So the owners were arrested. Most of it was neglect, or I guess a couple of felony.
The animal cruelty charges, there were three felony animal cruelty charges, and
yeah,
those were related to the three pigs that actually died due to their saying the state is saying neglect. All the other animal cruelty charges are due to animals not having water or food.
Right. So what is the status of those pigs now? We're a week plus since this all went down.
Mm-hmm. Here's kind of the situation. The pigs are, or all of the animals, in fact, are being held by the Polk County Sheriff's Office. They are, in essence, evidence, not any different than, say, a drug seizure. So they are classified, and no one has access to them except for the Polk County Sheriff's Office. There was a custody hearing that was on Monday that ran over the allotted time, so it's been continued to Friday. At that point, after final custody is determined, if Darlin's Rescue Ranch is going to get the pigs back or if they are going to be relinquished to Polk County Sheriff's Office, once that final custody is determined, then people will be able to get in and actually see these animals and, you know, provide help. PETA is providing feed for the animals. I was able to confirm that at the hearing on Monday. So they are being taken care of, but they are, no one has access to them right now.
So, Alana, I mean, in light of what we know or what we think we know, and certainly we've at least discussed in terms of the charges, what are the prospects that the owners of Darlin's would actually end up with those animals back in their possession?
Anything's possible. I don't want to speculate to that. Anything is possible. But listening to all the testimony, it does seem that the Polk County Sheriff's Office has a pretty good case. I'm truthfully not even sure if Darlin would want all of the animals back. She's been reaching out in the past to try and get some help with placement. Truthfully, I'm not. I'm not sure.
Will the continuation of that hearing, custody hearing on Friday, that will at least grant people access, but will that also determine whether they do still have custody, as it were, I guess,
yes,
of the animals?
Yes, that will determine the final custody, and then from what I understand, from that point, they have 30 days to appeal the custody hearing. So within that 30 days, it will be continuing to work on, assuming they are relinquished, that they will continue to work on finding placements, lining up volunteers for transports, donations, et cetera, for all of their care. But from what I understand, they do at least have an appeal window.
So in that 30 days, then, do those pigs just stay where they are?
Truthfully, I am not sure.
Yeah.
There may
because
be the option of transferring them to another location, but I would not anticipate that they would be dispersed into all of, you know, prospective homes that we have lined up within that appeal period.
Right, because then I guess potentially you might have to undo.
Correct.
Those placements, yeah.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, I don't know what the resources of the Polk County Sheriff Department is, but to suddenly be dealing with 130-some-odd pigs and the care and feeding every day, I would think they would be probably either ill-equipped or just overwhelmed, which seems to be sort of a through line to this story to begin with.
Exactly, and that's where Pig Advocates League is coming in. We want to make sure during that time that there's volunteers and there's money to provide additional feed if or vet services, anything that's needed. So the Polk County Sheriff's Office is not overburdened. I mean, this is a lot of animals for anyone one time to just all of a sudden take custody of. So that is our main priority, to make sure within, you know, the time that they are relinquished to the time they're placed in a new final placement, that they have enough resources.
So I think we should note here that, again, Pig Advocates League is, again, first of all, 501c3.
Yes.
And secondly, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is, I mean, this whole situation seems kind of tragic and at the moment a little bit desperate with a clock ticking and yet not ticking for the pigs and their care. But assuming they are relinquished, that's a lot of pigs to find homes for. And I think in the parlance of one of our presidential candidates, I'm sure all those homes, especially given what these pigs have been through, are going to need to undergo extreme vetting before anybody's going to...
That is one of the items that we are requesting, you know, volunteers for is, you know, to conduct home checks. We are screening. We are screening people. There are some rescues that have stepped in that have volunteered to take a few, but, I mean, every rescue in the country, in essence, is overburdened with animals, so no one's able to take this many at one time, but obviously we want to make sure that they don't go from a bad situation to worse.
Sure. Also, I guess, too, that's important in addition to saying that Pig Advocates League is 501c3. I mean, one of the reasons I also want to have you on in particular is that you guys seem very, very transparent about donations, and it seems like any donations that come in for the Polk Pigs, the entire dollar, if you donate a dollar, goes to...
Dollar for dollar will be going to the Polk Pigs, and I can assure you, if anything shall happen and these pigs are given back to the owners and the owners refuse any help from outside, you know, agencies, that, I mean, we have put out there that we will gladly refund donations that come in directly. We're doing a T-shirt campaign as well, and that's a little tricky to refund there, but obviously you're getting a shirt. But as far as donations that come in, if anything should fall through, we have no issue, you know, refunding or applying it to, you know, future endeavors that we take on helping animals. But most definitely, we are 100% on transparency.
So let's give a little bit of that information, and hopefully we'll have another minute or so to talk before we, unfortunately, kind of run out of time here, Lana. But let's give the email, I guess, is palpigs@gmail.com.
Palpigs@gmail.com is our email address if you're interested in volunteering, in any capacity or placing any of these animals or giving home, please email. PigAdvocatesLeague.com is our website, and you can make donations directly from the website. And then we are also doing a Polk Pigs T-shirt booster, and that is booster.com/PolkPigs.
And also, I guess I should note, there's a lot of information and other activity on Facebook, so people could go on Facebook.
On our Facebook page, facebook.com/pigadvocates, and tons of info. I do updates on there as soon as more information comes out. I'm not expecting really another update until Friday after the hearing, but we're doing daily updates in regards to fundraising, et cetera, on there.
And the updates are extremely detailed and very helpful and valuable, even if they're obviously very upsetting.
Yes.
You know, some of the conditions. So again, I mean, one of the things, I guess, that I've noted, and in a way, I guess you have too, in some of your updates, this case seems very emotionally charged. I mean, not only, of course, anytime you see a neglect or abuse on that scale, it's upsetting, but I think there's a lot of other issues that are kind of commingled with that, whether it's the PETA investigation and people's very mixed...
It's very divisive, and that's one of the reasons that Pig Advocates League wanted to get involved here, because there were so many concerns from people in the community. You know, I've been having a lot of communication with the head PETA people in regards to this investigation, and status and placement and whatnot. So I don't have anything negative to say in regards to that. They've been providing feed. I mean, the hope is that they'll continue to offset some of the placement costs once the animals, you know, are transferred to their final homes and whatnot. But it's a very emotional situation.
And I think, and I think, as I touched on last week, I mean, for anybody who knows of Darlin's or knows Darlin, I mean, I think it's emotional in that way. I mean, there have been signs, as it turns out, that she was in trouble or there was problems before, but I think a lot of people are a little bit surprised by kind of how things went down. So anyway, it's very complicated, and maybe we'll have you on again, Alana, for another update, because I think it's very important. And again, anybody who can help, email us palpigs@gmail.com and pigadvocatesleague.com for more information and to donate. And we're out of time. It's Talking Animals on WMNF Tempe. Thank you, Alana.
Thank you very much.
Our news in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman.